This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined today on the pod by an Associate Professor of Physics at the University of Albany, former NASA research scientist, lead scientist of UAPX, and also a member of the Natural Sciences Advisory Board for the Sol Foundation. All this among many professional and academic achievements. I'd like to welcome finally to the podcast, Dr. Kevin Knuth. Kevin, welcome to the pod.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you. And I appreciate the kind introduction. I have a little correction to make, and it's a good one. I'm now full professor of physics. So over the last year, I was promoted to full professor, which I treat as a pretty nice accomplishment, given that I was promoted while studying UFOs. So that's pretty good.
Do you know, normally I could go back and correct that and make myself sound better, but I think the fact you were promoted while studying UFOs deserves to be left in. So well done on that. And that's something that will probably come up during the body of the interview. Kevin, let's go over your own background first of all, because you have a quite storied list of achievements academically and professionally. Your introduction could have went on 5 minutes if I'd listed everything, so I've had to cut it down. But what is your own background and how did you come to be involved in the UFO topic from that?
Right. I've always been interested in UFOs. I was 12 years old back in 1977 when Star Wars came out. So that made a big impression on me. And I'm old enough to just barely remember the moon landings. I was 4 years old in 1969 when they first walked on the moon. And I remember we went to my grandmother's house to watch it on television. And we were leaving, and my father was carrying me down the stairs outside, and he got to the bottom of the sidewalk, and we stopped, and he looked up at the moon and pointed at it and said, "There are people up there." And I remember that had such a huge impression on me, and I've always wanted to go to the moon. And it was a big disappointment that we didn't keep going. I'm looking forward to the upcoming moon launches. But so I've always been interested in these things, And I grew up watching Star Trek. I remember getting up, not being able to sleep, and coming out and laying on the couch with my parents watching Star Trek late at night. And as a 5-year-old, I was a little confused by Spock with his pointy ears. I didn't quite understand why there was a giant elf on the bridge of the Enterprise. But so I was pretty young. But these things all made a big impression on me. And in 1977, there was the TV show In Search Of with Leonard Nimoy hosted that. And they very often covered UFOs. And we pretty much had that running on television every night while we had dinner or just after dinner. So I was always interested in UFOs. But I think a turning point was when I started graduate school. Well, I grew up in Wisconsin and then moved out to Montana for graduate school. I got my master's degree at Montana State University. And it was about the first 2 weeks of classes, just having moved out there. So this would have been early September 1988. And there was a cattle mutilation in Bozeman where two cows were killed and they were surgically altered or messed with. I don't know what the appropriate verb is there. And now I know more about cattle mutilations. It's a classic cattle mutilation. And and several of us new graduate students, were talking about this in the physics department hallway the next day, because this was all over the news and there were UFO sightings the night before. And so the news people are all hyped up. It's either aliens or Satanists. And I remember arguing that in the hallway, I don't know why an alien would do this, and I'm not sure why that a Satanist could. And so I remember saying that in the hallway. But we had this very heated discussion, mainly because we knew the new graduate students were trying to figure out what crazy place we just moved to, right? We're looking down the barrel of living here for 5 years, and it was a bit worrisome. And so while we're having this discussion, we disturbed one of the professors who came out of his office and came down the hall to see what we were talking about. And I think he tried to console us and said, well, it didn't work. I mean, basically said, well, these things happen from time to time and they investigate them and no one ever figures anything out. And then we all just forget about it until it happens again. And I was just kind of like, what? This is crazy. And then he added, at the end of that, he added, but you know what's really strange is I have friends who are in the Air Force up at Malmstrom Air Force Base, and they're having problems up there with UFOs flying over the nuclear weapon sites and shutting down our nuclear missiles. And he told us this, and he walked away, and I'll be honest, we laughed our butts off because none of us could imagine that that could really be going on and the Air Force wouldn't be on, you know, high alert, right? Shooting everything out of the sky that comes anywhere near the base. So it just seemed kind of silly. And so that was back in 1988 that I heard about that. And so now fast forward about almost 30 years, it was probably around 2015, I was teaching a course in astrophysics, it was an astronomy course. And my students were interested in, we were going to talk about astrobiology. And my students wanted to know what I could say about the possibility of aliens visiting Earth. And I didn't know what to talk about other than the Frank Drake's equation or the Fermi paradox. So I was just poking around on the internet just for an idea of what I could even talk about that would make any kind of sense in a physics class. And I stumbled on the press conference that Robert Hastings held in DC in 2010, where he had several people, former Air Force people, talking about UFO incursions at nuclear weapon sites. And the first person he had speak was Robert Salas, who was at Malmstrom Air Force Base, the same Air Force Base I had heard about. And I thought, and I was just dumbfounded. I thought, this is amazing. I heard about this 25 years ago from a physics professor. And here, this is the guy, this is a guy from the Air Force Base talking about an event that occurred in 1965 or 1966. And I thought, this can't be nonsense. This has to be real because these are serious people. You know, serious people just don't maintain stories like this for 40 years. That's not reasonable. And then it kind of struck me, it kind of sank in listening to these discussions on this press conference that we're in a bit of trouble because no one's taking this seriously. And this is very possibly extremely serious. And it just really started to worry me. And what did I talk about that next day in class? I made the horrible mistake. I showed the students part of that video. And I think I scared the bejesus out of them. they were all white-faced and ashen with their eyes open when it was done. And I didn't really even talk about anything. I just played part of that video. And then I had apologized profusely because I realized that they did not see that coming. And I think the seriousness of the situation really hit them like a ton of bricks. I think that was a little too rough. But it compelled me to start studying these things. I thought somebody has to be paying attention. So I started paying attention. So that was 2015. And then it was only 2 years later, 2017, what was it, December 16th, 2017, that the New York Times article came out about the ATIP program. Yeah. And then I was like, yeah, certainly I'm going to have to study these things because nobody else is. So the field's wide open. Somebody has to be paying attention. And I thought I'll try to do something. And that's how I got involved. That's the long story.
No, it's interesting because it's funny how as an academic, a scientist, however you want to kind of pigeonhole yourself, there are now more of you, if you include your Gary Nolan, Jacques Vallée, Beatrice Villarreal, all of those folks who are coming out more and more. And there are still so many who are on the opposite end of the spectrum, who poo-poo the subject, who don't want to talk about it. The stigma still, you know, they are. Neil deGrasse Tyson's one of the biggest names in the world. He's
a
good celebrity.
They haven't looked into it at all. That's the problem. They haven't even looked at it. And they're poo-pooing it, which is why Avi Loeb's Galileo Project's called what it's called. I mean, he called it the Galileo Project because of the bishops that refused to look through Galileo's telescope. And that's how these other prominent skeptics are. They're not skeptics. They're denialists. They're not being skeptical. Being skeptical is being skeptical works both ways. You're skeptical of everything. And so you should be skeptical of, equally skeptical of people who say that there are alien spacecraft in our operating in our environment, as you are of people who say that's impossible. You should be skeptical of both. You need evidence is what you need. And that, you know, that requires research and work. And yeah, if you don't want to put the work in on this problem, that's fine. Don't do it. But you can't poo-poo people who are.
What do you think the difference is, though, as a scientist to want to explore that and want to investigate that? You mentioned Galileo, and I'll bastardize this, but famously, he was ostracized at the time for believing, for daring to believe the Earth went around the sun and not the other way around. And I know Professor Brian Cox here in the UK, very famous scientist, he always cites his hero as Galileo. But on the other hand, he will always say he has no interest in the UFO subject. Aliens aren't coming here. And that's a broad term, I understand, but there's nothing coming here. It's too far away. He just doesn't have an interest in the subject. Yet his hero was ostracized for something very similar back in the time. So it just seems that as a scientist, you would want to be involved in what no doubt would be one of the great discoveries in human history. Isn't that right?
I can, as a scientist, whenever you are confronted with a problem that you're going to consider looking into, you have to consider a few things. You know, is there a chance of success? Is there any way I can figure this out? Can I make any headway here? Is this problem for me in some way? And that's an important question to ask. Another one, is it worth doing? You know, is what you're going to discover going to be meaningful at all, or is it not going to be very important? So there's, and then how hard is it going to be? How much time is it going, am I going to invest? You have to do your homework. You're going to have to research what other people have done. In this case, there's not a lot of scientific work that's been done, but there are people in ufology who have accumulated information. So they, you know, it's not data like you would want from a science project, scientific program, but it is information that you can learn from. So you have to weigh all of those factors. And I think that, you know, everybody's going to do a slightly different calculus based on their interests and their abilities and their time. And it's perfectly fine for a scientist to look at this and say, yeah, there probably isn't anything here. I'm not going to study it. That's fine. But to take the next step and be critical of those who decide to study it, I think is a big problem. I mean, that's not being rational at all. And so... So I have several colleagues who are curious about this, and they're interested in what's going on, interested in asking me for updates and what I've learned. But they'll say, yeah, this is interesting, but yeah, not for me. And that's cool. That's fine.
Yeah, that's a very fair way to put it. I wonder, you've mentioned your own background and as growing up, that very typical childhood interest in the UFO topic, Star Trek, Star Wars, you know, that's how many of us get into this subject in a way. Did you have any either sightings or experiences of your own or family sightings that also helped progress that?
I have actually, and it's hard because I never treated it as a sighting because I wasn't sure what I was looking at. It was unidentified, right? So I never sorry, excuse me. So I never treated it as a, you know, as something important. I was in college. I was working as a computer programmer at Mercury Marine that makes mercury outboards for boats. And I was leaving work. And this is my hometown of Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And I was leaving work, walking across the parking lot, and I spotted an F-16. And I thought, oh, cool, an F-16. And my hometown is just at the southern tip of Lake Winnebago in Wisconsin. So when you look at Wisconsin, I guess you're seeing it right. You've got Green Bay here, Milwaukee is down here, and there's this little lake here called Lake Winnebago. And my hometown is right at the foot of that. And up along the west coast of Lake Winnebago is the town of Oshkosh, Wisconsin, where they used to have, or they used to, they still do, they have the Experimental Aircraft Association fly-in, the EAA fly-in. every year you would have experimental aircraft come in, planes, you know, from World War II, World War I, everything. There'd be 100,000 people there. It was ginormous. And so we would go almost every year. My grandfather had taken me and my father took me. And that happens usually in July in the summer. And so spotting an F-16, I knew what an F-16 was. I had seen them a million times. I saw this F-16 flying and I thought, cool, an F-16. And then I thought, well, wait a minute, it's June. We're a month early from the EAA. Why is there an F-16 up there? And I'm also a lifelong bird watcher. So I have a pair of binoculars in my car. So I ran to my car, grabbed my binoculars and looked at the F-16 and then realized there were two of them. And there are two of them streaking in from the north, and they kind of split up, and I followed one of them, and they both came back around, and they started circling, and I realized they were circling an object that was spherical. There was a large metal sphere. It was about a third of the length of the F-16. So an F-16 is what, 126 feet, something like that. So this thing was about 40 feet across. And at the time I thought it's a weather balloon and these guys are in doing some kind of exercise with a weather balloon. And that was what I imagined. And I watched them fly around this thing like bees. And then two more F-16s came in from the west and there were four of them just buzzing around this metallic looking sphere. I watched for about 3 minutes or so. And then I made the big mistake. I thought, my brother has to see this. And so, I mean, that's not a mistake. But the mistake was we didn't have cell phones. It was either the early June of 88 or June of 87. I don't remember which year, which is hard. And I thought, my brother has to see this. So I got in my car and drove home, which about 5-7 minutes to get home. Hopped out of the car, ran in the house, grabbed my brother, took him outside and said, you got to see this. You had these four F-16s are doing some kind of exercise up here. And by the time we got outside to look, it was just a rat's nest of contrails and nothing. I don't know what happened to the sphere. I don't know what happened to the planes. So I don't know what happened. But I always imagined that it was an exercise and it was just a weather balloon. But in talking with people from the Air Force later, I was told that, there wouldn't have been an exercise over the city. They wouldn't have been doing that. And there wouldn't have been an exercise involving a weather balloon. You don't fly an F-16 anywhere near a weather balloon because you suck that thing into the air intake and the plane goes down. Yeah. And I thought, well, that makes sense. So what was it? And everybody I've talked to said, no idea, no idea what it was. But it wasn't an exercise and it wasn't a weather balloon. So it never really felt like I had seen something unusual, but in retrospect, looking at it, I probably had. And now I wish I'd have been able to take photos. I wish I'd have watched the whole thing. I wish I'd have, that the sphere was stationary. It was just stationary. It was a clear blue sky. It just sat there for 3 minutes, didn't move, didn't do anything. They just buzzed around it like bees. It was very odd.
I would like to know, what do you find most intriguing about the UFO topic? You've had the childhood interest, your own sighting, which is a really interesting one. And I think you've done, which many of us have done, where you've had a sighting or experience and you've left before it finished. I done the same when I was a child, where I saw something interesting, pretty low down, Ferris wheel type object on its side. I was about 10 or 11 years old, but I was with my mum, my sister, a friend and his mum, and it wasn't even up in the sky. It was so low down, you couldn't see the bottom of the object behind houses that were about half a mile away. Wow. In a very, very built up urban area. So yeah, and if it was a Ferris wheel, everyone on board was dead because of the speed it was spinning. So, but we looked at it, saw it, and then left. It was the mid-90s, so no camera phones, you know, nothing like that as well. But I always wish we'd stayed a little bit longer and looked at it. My mum, who has no interest in the UFO topic, if I ask her now, she remembers it. But if I ask her even to draw what she saw, she can't remember. All she remembers is she saw something really strange. So it's an odd one. But I wonder, what do you find right now, given your involvement, the people you know, the people you speak to, and we're going to get onto the Saul Foundation in just a moment, the most intriguing aspect of the UFO topic?
There are two things that I find really intriguing. One is the most intriguing is their association with water. And now, according to Arrow and Congress, the acronym UAP supposedly stands for unidentified aerospace underwater phenomena, right, or undersea phenomena. And that underwater aspect is horribly, horribly neglected. And in fact, today I think Admiral Gaudelet has put out the Sol's first white paper, which has to do with the undersea aspects or underwater aspects of UFOs. I think that's the most neglected aspect of these things. And I can say that I had over the last year and a half, me and the UAPX team, we briefed Senator Gillibrand's team twice. We've briefed the U.S. House of Representatives Armed Services Committee. We briefed Arrow, and we briefed the Department of National Intelligence. And they all asked us one question that they had in common. And it was the main question that we were asked was, what are your capabilities for observing underwater? That's what everybody wants to know. And that is clearly the most important aspect of UFOs, unidentified flying objects, that there is. It's the underwater aspect. It's been horribly ignored, but it's clearly the most important aspect. And I find that
Admiral. I was going to just say, Admiral Gallaudet's paper, I literally saw the link for it about half an hour before we recorded, so I've not had the chance to look over that yet. So if anyone's thinking, ask about it or follow up, I've not read it yet. It has literally just dropped before we hit the record.
I barely had a chance to look at it before. I saw it about the same time you did, and I barely had a chance to look at it myself, but I was glad that it came out. That, I think, is the most neglected aspect of these things, which I find fascinating.
And what was the second? We're going to come back to the underwater question.
Oh, the second one's the difficult part. And it was, if you've seen me in Netflix's Encounters, I'm in episode 3 of Encounters, and when they talk about the sightings in Wales, and the opening scene that I'm in is actually the first thing that we filmed. I didn't even know the cameras were running, which is why they said that. But the director asked me, tell us a secret, that you haven't told anybody about UFOs. And all I could think was, on television? Are you kidding me? But I didn't even know we were running it. I was like, are the cameras running? I didn't know. And so that's actually what you see in the film. But the second aspect is related to a secret about UFOs. And that is the strange aspect that they are people who have witnessed them or come close to them or claim to have been taken on board all experience weird paranormal phenomena afterwards. It's common, and that's what people report. We don't have hard evidence of this. I can't easily go into details. I'm not sure what to believe, but that's what people report. And that's very, very odd. I mean, so these phenomena range from encountering beings that are communicating with them telepathically. I don't know how that works. I'm a scientist. That doesn't make sense to me. But it's widely reported. People report levitating afterwards, like by themselves when they've been back in the house. They'll be levitating in the kitchen. It's really strange. People say strange things. So, are these things really happening to people? I don't know. Have their brains been messed with or scrambled in some way? Maybe. I don't know. I really am not at liberty to say what the truth of the situation is. But it's those aspects of the reports I find very bizarre and very strange. And it's hard to know what to think. It would be super easy to just blow it off, right, and say, clearly this is all nonsense. But I don't think it's all nonsense. There's something interesting here because it's widely reported across cultures, across time. And those are the things you pay attention to. That's where you learn stuff. But
absolutely, yeah. We're going to come back to those, okay, and I'm glad you brought it up. Anyone watching just saw me move to the side. I was just making a little note to come back to both of those points, but I've got questions that are going to come up to those. So let's go to the Sol Foundation presentation. You talked about the physics of UAP. I love that you corrected yourself, though, and said, look, they're UFOs. Let's talk about UFOs, because I prefer the term UFO, because that's what we're talking about here.
That's what I'm interested in. Those are the underwater ones, the USOs, right?
Absolutely. And they're all one and the same, potentially. You started your presentation with the line, I am skeptical. And that isn't a bad thing. I remember Lou Elizondo, when he was first doing his rounds on the podcast circuit and media, was telling people to be skeptical. You know, you don't have to believe him. Look at the data. Listen to everyone. Make up your own mind. Why do you feel then, as a scientist, or even anyone who has a basic interest in the UFO topic, why is being skeptical not a bad thing?
It's a safeguard against being wrong. That's really all it is. You can't accept everything you're told at face value, even from your instruments. You don't do that. You know, when you're doing measurements in the lab, you calibrate your instruments, you test them, and then you take your measurements and then you calibrate them again and test it again to make sure that they're telling you what you think they're telling you. That's what you have to do to make sure that you're not wrong. And it's true with anything. And that kind of being skeptical is important, you know, in any context. And here especially, it's important to be skeptical. I can't possibly believe that everything everybody sees is an alien spacecraft. I don't believe that. So I'm skeptical of that, but I'm also skeptical of the people who say that it can't possibly be an alien spacecraft, because I don't think that's true either. You don't ever assign a probability of 0 or 1 to anything. That ensures you can't learn. There's a theorem called Bayes' theorem. You throw a 1 or a 0 in there and learning stops. So that's assuming you know everything or know what's true, and we don't know the truth. So we have to be skeptical.
I've got song lyrics tattooed on my arm, which is all we know is that we don't know. And I think that's a good way to kind of live life and apply a lot of things. Although one of your quotes here is, and I love this, unknown engineering can look a lot like anomalous physics. And I wonder, Kevin, what is the probability that our greatest scientists, our greatest engineers have managed to devise this type of technology? If we look at modern day, we look at Tic Tacs, we look at the gimbal footage, you know, Go Fast. What is the chance, and this is, I suppose, from a skeptic's point of view, that Lockheed Martin or whoever it may be have managed to develop technology that we're talking about now?
That's a good question, and it's not clear. I think, unfortunately, those videos, which were very influential and important, they're not spectacular. They, in fact, are given what the pilots have reported. Those videos are showing the most boring aspects of these encounters that happen. So, which is unfortunate. I would like to see some of the more exciting, you know, see videos of some of the more exciting encounters. That would be helpful. It is possible that somebody engineered something and is testing something. I mean, that you can't rule that out. And that's one of the problems about saying that, you know, these things are extraterrestrial. In fact, we have moved away from that in some ways, especially Congress has, which, you know, to their credit, they use the term non-human intelligence, NHI. And this was used a good bit at Seoul as well, because proving something extraterrestrial is really hard. You're going to have to prove it came from another planet. That's not clear how to do that. It's not clear how one would go about doing that. And the fact that we've seen, you know, we know that UFOs are related to water. There's some suspicion that what if they're living underwater? They're not coming from, in fact, Carl Sagan used this as an argument decades ago. He said, I have a hard time believing that somebody is arriving from interstellar space every week. Which, yeah, exactly. That's a big problem. And in fact, I wish I could have a conversation with him, because I'd grab him by the head and say, Carl, you're almost there. One more logical step and you've got it. Because they're not arriving here every week. They live here. That's the conclusion. Their reaction time to problems like the Fukushima nuclear disaster after the tsunami, which is in episode 4 of Encounters. I've pitched this show twice now. but they arrived the next day. There were UFOs there the next day. So how far away are they coming from? Well, that puts a half light day radius around the Earth, because it would take half a day for a light to get there. Information about the nuclear disaster would have to travel out, and then somebody would have to travel back at the speed of light to get here on time. So they're coming from at least within the solar system and probably Earth. So they probably live here. So are they extraterrestrial? We don't actually know. Could they have evolved here? Like they're just another living Earth thing that we didn't learn about yet? Very possible. Our oceans are very, very poorly explored. We know very little about our oceans. We know more about the surface of Mars than we know about our oceans. And so there's a lot that we don't know. And then going back to the original question, you know, could a company have come up with some of these things and be testing them? Yeah, that's possible. It would be surprising for them to be doing that in a naval training area, because that would be highly illegal and dangerous, and they could stand to lose valuable equipment that way. So that's hard to believe, but you can't rule it out.
It's interesting you say about the next step of this conversation for Carl Sagan was being realizing they're closer, they're not coming from that far away. And I try and have that conversation with people in everyday life, people I work with in the office, and they'll ask, you know, UFO podcast you've got, and I'm like, yeah, and have a little chat with them. Very quickly I come away from, what if they're not coming from that far away? And that gets them on the back foot and gets them listening at least. And as soon as you mention maybe they're coming from here and underwater, so many folks check out of the conversation and struggle to have that chat. And I wonder, and some of the data you discussed in your presentation, which is relatively well known now, is the radar data that Kevin Day reported was these objects, the tic-tacs, came from a ceiling of around 28,000 feet to just on sea level in less than a second, not 0.78 seconds. Now, your formula shows to a layman like me that would have equated, the energy required would have been around 10 times the nuclear output of the entire United States for that sort of movement and speed to be generated. And I wonder, why is data like that being ignored or completely overlooked by the public and the mainstream media? Is that because pictures and videos, as boring or prosaic as they may look, is more appealing than hearing data like that from a scientist?
That's a good question as to why it's being ignored. I don't really know. It's not being ignored by everybody. In fact, a number of scientists that are studying UFOs now or are interested in doing so were compelled by that data in that paper. So at one point there was an editorial accusing them of being simple calculations, right, as a derogatory thing. However, the simple calculations are the compelling ones. It's the complex calculations that are the ones that you worry about as being right. The simple ones could have been done by anybody, and I'll repeat, should have been done by any of the physicists who have ever been introduced to these problems. It's the first thing you do when you encounter a problem like this. You hear that this thing dropped from 28,000 feet to sea level in 0.78 seconds. You grab a piece of paper and you write down, You scribble out those equations, and a professional physicist can do that in 30 seconds. They should have their answer. And why doesn't you know, our popular, our physics science popularizers do this. Why don't they do this? I don't know. They're not, they are really not interested. And I think they have investment in not being interested at this point. Why didn't Sean Kirkpatrick do this? I don't know. Sean Kirkpatrick knew about that paper too. And he denied its existence to Senator Gillibrand later, a month later. So it's, I don't know exactly what's going on. There is a atmosphere of denial here where people, I'm starting to believe that some people are scared by this and don't want it to be true. And that worries them. It's going to change their worldview. It's going to create all sorts of problems that they're not prepared for. And I think that that's part of what's going on. But these are easy calculations to do, and we do have data for a lot of them. And actually, I'm going back through trying to collect more cases where you can estimate speeds and accelerations. I stumbled on one the other day where a physicist had calculated the acceleration of something that a Marine took photos of and wrote in a letter that this acceleration is insanely high. That never got published anywhere, but I stumbled on this letter then, so I'm going to work and publish these things because this has been known by some for a long time. I mean, Hermann Oberth, I mentioned this in my Soul Talk, Hermann Oberth, who was mentor of Wernher von Braun, so he's a rocketry pioneer, had given a talk in 1954 on UFOs and discussed the fact that they had been measured traveling at speeds of 19 kilometers a second. So quick, those of you listening, go to Google, figure out how fast it is. That's around 40,000 miles an hour. So Hermann Oberth knew this and reported this from over 50 radar observations, he says in his talk, say that these things can travel at 40,000 miles an hour. That's spacecraft speed. The space station and the space shuttle only goes about 17,000 miles an hour. So the New Horizons probe to Pluto is traveling about 45,000 miles an hour. So we know that these things are traveling at spacecraft speeds. And that's been well known for a long time by some, and it continues to be ignored by others, which is why I joke in my talk why Oberth looks so grumpy, because nobody's listening to him even after, you know, 60 years or 70 years.
Yeah, I did like that. You got a laugh from a very tough audience, I'm sure it would have been if those things were to fall flat.
Well, he really does look grumpy. I mean, it really struck me that, and he should be grumpy. I mean, that's really upsetting. I mean, he told people this in 1954. We should have been on top of this in 1954. And we still are not on top of it. And a lot of that is thanks to AeroNow. AeroNow is still trying to claim there's nothing to see here. There's been nothing to see here. Why wasn't Hermann Oberth discussed in the report? That's historical. He was a scientist. His assessment should have been discussed. It wasn't. There's big problems here.
Let me ask then, you mentioned earlier your second point when I asked you the two things that intrigue you. You mentioned the strangeness, the paranormal, whether it's the hitchhiker effect, Havana syndrome comes into that, no doubt, and all the other weird and wonderful events that can follow someone, poltergeist activity after a sighting or experience, is an aspect of this phenomenon, which isn't widely investigated because it's hard to do that. And I wonder, if there's multiple different phenomena all at play here when it comes to UFOs and UAPs, do you think we're studying this the right way? And if not, do you think there's a better strategy to go after investigating and studying the UAP phenomenon?
That's a good question. And I think that this is studies of UAPs are going to have to evolve. I think at the moment, we are still stuck in the stage where you have to prove that they are real and prove they're interesting or anomalous. And this is a stage of science where science looks very much like pseudoscience. Pseudoscience in science, you basically disprove hypotheses. And pseudoscience is typically characterized by trying to prove one hypothesis, focused on that hypothesis and trying to prove it. Now, the problem is that science kind of sets things up so that if there's a new phenomenon, nobody's going to believe it's real unless you prove it's real. So you have to first prove that this phenomenon is real. But now you're trying to prove a hypothesis which makes it look like pseudoscience. So how do you get out of this cycle? I mean, you're almost set up. The system's almost set up for failure. It's set up so you can't discover anything new. And that's really a logical problem with science. Once you get past that and actually start studying characteristics of the phenomenon, then you can start ruling out hypotheses and acting like science. So the trick is, to make any progress here, you have to give up trying to prove that they're real, give up trying to prove that it's anomalous. Instead, characterize them. Do what some people and what some scientists call biology stamp collecting. Characterize everything, right? And there's an old quote, I think, from Rutherford or something like that. So just try to characterize them and collect information, and then try to see what you can learn from that. And what we found is the easiest thing to characterize at this point are their speeds and accelerations. That's the easiest thing to measure. And those speeds and accelerations are really anomalous, and that you can demonstrate. So I think that's right now is the best way to attack the problem. And then try to figure out what they are. How are you traveling at 40,000 miles through the atmosphere without a sonic boom or a fireball? I don't know how that works. I don't know how you can do that. But now that's something you could study to try to understand. So I think that's the way you have to begin. You have to break through in steps. And, once we've established, to some degree what these things are like, we can start studying more, detailed aspects of them.
But I wonder, Kevin, how do you do that in a very skeptical modern society where 50% of people say black, 50% say white? And I don't mean in skin color, God, by any means, before I get cancelled, but I just mean in terms of any argument, it's so polarized on different sides, especially if you look at social media. And I even wonder if a body was wheeled out, and I liked your use of, let's forget the White House lawn, let's say Central Park. If they wheeled out a body at a press conference in Central Park and said, here's an alien body, 50% of people would believe that was real. 50% of people would say it's a false flag, disinformation, PSYOP campaign. It seems very difficult now to do that. So even if you can prove here's an object going 40,000 miles an hour, half the folks will say, wow, that's non-human. Half the folks are going to say that's just Boeing, British Airways, Lockheed Martin testing top secret technology. Does it just become very difficult nowadays to do that?
Right. So if that's the case, the main argument against, so some people are going to look at that and say, well, clearly it's non-human technology. Fine. Okay. If you believe that, that's okay. Other people are going to say that's Boeing or Lockheed Martin or somebody. They probably would actually say that the data clearly has to be wrong. So now you've got to work on demonstrating that the data isn't wrong. So you've got to use multiple instruments. You can collect your own data. You do it carefully, make sure things are calibrated, which means you can't rely on military videos. You don't know that these things are well calibrated. You don't know that the person who's using them they're not using them in an experimental context. They're using them in a totally different situation. That's difficult. So you'd have to attack that problem. You're going to have to attack the showing that the data's real, and the data's accurate and precise. And that's why we're trying to collect our own data now. So we at UAPX, the people at on other projects are also trying to collect their own data. And that's how you'll make progress eventually. Eventually, we'll collect data where people will look at it and say, well, yeah, okay, now this is interesting. And, and if somebody still says, well, it's Boeing and Lockheed Martin, the answer is, well, what are they doing? Try to figure out what they're doing. How does it work? Let's figure out what Lockheed Martin's up to. That's fine. I don't have any problems with that because maybe we'll get at the truth. Maybe they are doing something. And if it's not them, you should be able to rule that out with more data. But it's a long game. This is the long game, and it's not. We're not going to get answers. And you're right. Things are so polarized. Things are so. It's difficult because if the Pentagon came out later this afternoon and said, "Yeah, there are aliens. We have alien bodies. We have spaceships. Here's a photo." I'm not sure I would believe it. You know, let's see the evidence. Let's see all the evidence. And you're right. I'm not sure I would believe it if they came out and said if it's real. And I don't believe it when they're coming out and saying that it's all nonsense. I don't believe that either. These are the same guys. Remember, these are the same guys who said Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons of mass destruction. I mean, come on, we can't. And they've had stories for Roswell. Their story for Roswell has changed like 5 times over the last 80 years. I mean, one of their explanations of Roswell was that they were testing a Mars lander, a saucer-shaped Mars lander. Who's testing a Mars lander in 1947, 10 years before we knew we could have satellites? Really? That's your explanation? That's what the Air Force said in the 90s. And then they said they were dropping dummies. Well, why are you... The question is, why do you feel you need to explain something that's saucer-shaped and has dummies? What actually happened in Roswell? Why don't you tell us what data you collected instead of giving us explanations, ridiculous explanations? And I always say that the first explanation that came out of the Army Air Force was that they captured a disc. And that story got quashed the next day, and it got replaced with all sorts of ridiculous stories since. So what do you believe? You believe the first story is what you believe. The first one's probably the true one. But that's just me. I mean, that's how I would handle it. But you can't trust these guys until they produce information, you know, and Kirkpatrick and Arrow has said that, you know, that's all nonsense. Well, if Roswell's nonsense, let's see some of the documentation. There were troops there. Where are the requisitions for these troops? What are their orders? Why didn't you release those? General Ramey, when photographed with the material that was just balsa wood and aluminum foil, that was supposed to be, that was from the object they collected, and the person who collected him said it was not the same as material. Ramey is clearly holding a top secret memo. Let's see the top secret memo. What does that top secret memo say? Release that. Let's see it. There was a C-45 transport plane that they took of this material that they collected, you know, back to Fort Worth, Texas. Where's the requisition for that plane? What are the orders for that plane? Let's see that. You know, release some of this information. You know, release the documents. But no, they don't release any documents. They just say, oh, it was Project Mogul. Now that's the story. It was Project Mogul. Although, according to the professor at NYU who ran Project Mogul, he says they didn't launch a balloon in June. So there were no balloons up. And if they had, it would have been illegal. So they would have broken the law. So how was it Project Mogul? That's a good question. And Project Mogul, what was that? Project Mogul is the current excuse for what Roswell was. They were trying to figure out how to get a balloon to hover at 50,000 feet with a radio transponder that can detect electromagnetic signals from nuclear blasts from Russia, from nuclear testing. They wanted to hover this at 50,000 feet because that was the optimal altitude to be able to pick up these signals. And the problem was it was hard to get a balloon to hover at 50,000 feet because rubber balloons typically go up. And as they go up, they expand because the air pressure is less. And that makes them go up higher. They expand more. They go up higher. They expand more until they pop and they fall. And that's typically what happens. So the whole Project Mogul was about trying to figure out how to keep a balloon hovering at 50,000 feet. And that's what that project was for. And So why was that so top secret now still that they can't release any of that information? It's a technology about getting a balloon to hover. That's doesn't sound that hard to me anymore. And if the balloon would have been released in early June and was recovered, having crashed in late June, beginning of July, that means that you've got a balloon hovering over Roswell, New Mexico for 30 days, or at least 3 weeks. Really? It's not going to get caught up by the jet stream and go somewhere else? It just hovered over New Mexico, that area of New Mexico, that county for 30 days? That's hard to believe. And it's hard to believe they didn't know anything was there. They're supposedly got a radar reflector on this thing so they can track it. Yet the Air Force didn't know that it had crash landed, and nobody tried to retrieve it until Mac Brazel found it on his ranch. So what were these guys actually doing? They weren't doing a good job of tracking their balloon. So I've got a lot of questions about Project Mogul, if they're going to use that as the excuse. But what I want to see from Arrow is the evidence. What's the evidence that it was Project Mogul? I'm skeptical, and I want to see the evidence. Skepticism works both ways, my friend, and I'm sorry. I don't think it was Project Mogul. I think something extraordinary happened. I don't know what it was. I would like to see the evidence, though.
No, I appreciate that, and you gave a lot of good arguments for that as well. I've always been on the side that Roswell was definitely something non-human. We'll go with that.
Something happened. I mean, they had the rancher was detained for 5 days and questioned and threatened. You're going to question and threaten somebody about balloons with a radio transponder? Really? And if the military is going to do that, I think somebody has to answer to that. That shouldn't be legal.
I think one of the issues.
Something else Congress should look into, as if they don't have enough to do already.
No. And one of the issues, Kevin, with the UFO topic, and you'll appreciate as a scientist, is many of the, and almost exclusively, all incidents and events, experiences, abductions are reactive. They are happening before you know it, and you're in the middle of it, or you're seeing it, like with your incident. You mentioned during your talk, one of your colleagues at UAPX, Matthew Zagadis, was inventing a handheld nuclear reactor, essentially, with the plan to essentially bait and bring these UAP or UFOs.
That was the inspiration for his invention, at least. I don't know if we'll actually use it for that, but but that was the idea.
Well, that's something that's been talked about, isn't it? Using nuclear reactors or nuclear fuel. To bait these things, they seem drawn to them. Was there any update on that? Because the talk was back in November. And I just wonder, how exactly do you think, or would you foresee that working?
Well, I think the update is that his reactor works. I've seen it. It seems to be working. They've tested it. You get fission, the thing fizzes. It's not, you get nuclear fission, apparently. It looks like it's successful, and he's continuing to test it. But now, because it's more public, we can't. I mean, nobody should be carting around a nuclear reactor trying to lure in UFOs. I mean, there should be some legal, there should be some oversight here. So I don't think we're going to be able to bait them in with his nuclear reactor, but his nuclear reactor is now a reality and they're testing it, and which is fantastic. So
I think the Ghostbusters got into trouble for something very similar, for running about.
Yeah, I don't want to get it. I don't want to go head to head with the red haired guy who, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's
cats and dogs sleeping together. We don't need that.
But I'm guessing, and this goes into probably my last question on the talk itself, is you finished talking about, like you say, the oceans and how other planetary bodies' oceans are somewhere we should also be looking at. I think many are now in a place where speculating that advanced life forms could either be based in or living in our oceans. Again, what does that look like for you? And this is speculation I appreciate. Do you think we have empty drones that have been left behind or put here by something else, or do you think we have full-fledged, and I hate to say the word alien, but alien bases with these things
or living beings?
Craft?
yeah,
I wonder, how do you compute that?
It's a good question. I don't some of these appear to be, you know, autonomous drones, perhaps, but it's not clear. I don't think we have answers yet, and that's something I'd certainly like to know. I don't think we have answers to this, but it's going to require a lot more investigation. It's going to require some monitoring of our oceans, which is difficult to do. Most satellite companies don't monitor our oceans, so we aren't collecting imagery over the oceans, which has been a problem for ships that have gone missing and people trying to get satellite data on the missing ships. That's been a problem the last few years. So there's reasons for doing it, but not enough ships go missing that you worry about doing it all the time. The oceans cover 75% of the surface of the planet. I mean, this is a water planet. I always joke, you know, after Uranus, this is probably the worst named planet in our solar system. We called it Earth. It's water. The planet should be called water or ocean. That's what it is. Mm. It's a water planet. And I don't think we really, you know, as land-dwelling creatures, I don't think we have a good appreciation for that yet. You know, there are a few people who do. Admiral Gallaudet does for sure, but most of us don't.
If I was to give you and Admiral Gallaudet a budget of, you know, $50 million tomorrow, and I said to you, is there any particular area of interest in the ocean? Is there anywhere you would go first?
Well, there are hotspots. There are places where people have seen UFOs related to water. And when UAPX went to Catalina Island to monitor the Catalina Channel, that's one of the places. That's where the 2004 Nimitz encounters would start. The UAPs would appear on Kevin Day's radar at about 80,000 feet around the southern area of Catalina Island. So that's one place. Northern Puerto Rico is another place where there are sightings. Off the coast of Wales is another place that I mentioned in the TV, or that's discussed in the TV show. There's places in Australia. I'm going to be going to Long Island later this week to basically monitor the coast to watch for UAPs myself. So we're going to collect data there as well. So there are places to look, and setting up permanent observation stations would probably be a smart thing to do, especially in the places where these things have been seen. And then the second thing I would do is try to come up with ways to better monitor underwater. You know, are there ways we can watch underwater? Our only real access underwater is sonar, which is not ideal. So it's hard to know exactly what to do.
Well, that's fair. Kevin, I want to move into listener questions. Like I say, we have had a lot sent in to the podcast. I had to do a lot of culling here. So apologies if you don't hear your question. We'll get through as many of them as we can. They'll jump all over the place, but Kevin's been very generous with his time to get through these. So Kevin, first up, question from Newman. Newman says, at the 2021 conference of the AIAA, Kevin presented MWIR-LWIR footage of a mysterious trefoil-shaped craft seemingly shadowing a jet plane as recorded by UAPX engineer David Mason. What is UAPX current state of analysis and conclusions on the footage? That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament of Funk. The little fucker hovered right inside of my...